So before I get into this episode, I'd like to bring to light something I've been working on. If you're subscribed to my blog, you've probably heard of my Hunter Up initiative. If not, I'll try to sum it up for you. I'm afraid that hunting as we know it can go away, especially with the declining numbers of new hunters each year. I think it's so very important that we take the time and make a true effort to take the bull by the horns, and each and every one of us personally introduce one new hunter into hunting. I'm also very unhappy with the hunting community as a whole, and its lack of respect for fellow hunters. We as a community spend a lot of time bashing each other over stupidity instead of promoting one another. The amount of energy that we spend arguing can be spent on more important things like conservation or introducing a kid into hunting. So I'm issuing all of you a challenge to take the time to help fellow hunters, introduce kids, and for God's sakes, stop promoting content that puts hunters in a bad light. Resist the urge to engage in these foolish arguments that we have. Stop the bashing. When you feel strongly about something or you disagree with a hunter, a fellow hunter, take that subject off social media, message that person directly, have a one-on-one debate about it. You're either going to leave understanding where that other person's coming from, or you're going to have said your piece and you move on. We're not all going to agree with the way others do things. And we don't have to. But what we should be doing is supporting all legal hunting, because all we're doing is showing weakness and unrest within our community. And this just leaves chinks in the armor that let hunting, anti-hunting groups tear down what you have built, what we've all built. And we need to support hunting and hunters and use our efforts for good, like conservation and hunters education and introducing new hunters, instead of wasting our time arguing about who predator hunts, who uses a Matthews and who uses a Hoyt. I mean, the stupid arguments that go on is just, it's okay to have debate, it's okay to have opinion, but really think about what it does when you argue on social media. You got to understand, if there's something that's negative out there and you keep pushing it, I can't stress enough, if you don't understand the way Facebook algorithm works or Instagram or any of these, it's you comment on something, oh, you're an idiot for putting that out there. And you commenting on that just pushes that content up the ladder further and further until it gets wider and wider and the net gets larger and larger. And the more people can see it, the more people comment on it, the more people can see it. And eventually it's going to get in front of the eyes of somebody who's an anti-hunter and not just arguing about the hunt. And it's not good for us. So please stop the bashing and get out there and help introduce hunters into hunting. Thanks again. And this episode, you can thank Phoenix Shooting Bags for bringing it to you. And this hunter initiative, they're helping me out with it. I appreciate what they're doing. And let's just jump into the next episode. Thank you.
Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by the Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we are talking actually to one of my, I can't say mentor, because I don't know if he knew that he was helping me out, because I was just reading his books. One of the guys that I studied a lot early on when I was trying to perfect my whitetail game. I read a lot of his books and watched a lot of his videos and listened to him about his calling techniques and different things on the rut. and it's Peter Fiducia, and you might have heard me talk about him here and there before, but I have him on today, and we're going to talk a little bit about deer and deer hunting. How's it going, Peter?
Well, John, how about you?
Good, good, real good. My kids' school got the teachers walked out, so yeah, so the kids are home today and tomorrow, and kind of threw off the day a little bit for my wife and I. But
nice.
You know, we're rolling with the punches. Hopefully they'll resolve that matter, and hopefully get back on track. But so, why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself?
Sure.
Before we get into this.
For the last 35 years, I've been in the outdoor industry. I started with writing articles for all the major magazines in the early 80s, and mostly everything I do is on whitetails. Then somewhere around 1984, 86, we started the Woods and Water TV series on a local basis. And in 86, it went national on a network back then that was very much like the Outdoor Channel of today. And then somewhere around 90, we went on to the Outdoor Channel, and the program is now going into its 34th year. And we're on Pursuit Network and a bunch of VOD networks. And it's mostly about big game hunting, but my expertise lies mostly with whitetail deer. Sometime around the late 1990s, Hall of Famer Wade Boggs was a co-host on the TV show, and he gave me the nickname the Deer Doctor, and that has stuck ever since. I wasn't a big fan of it when he first used it, but now it's just been Peter Fiducia, the Deer Doctor. It's really been a good career. I mean, I during that whole time with the magazines, I still write for magazines. I've written 14 books, and all of them are on whitetail deer. And
yep.
So
I've read several of them.
Oh, do you? Well, that's good to
hear.
Somebody's buying that, huh?
honestly, my favorite is the whitetail strategies one. I have the first edition, and the second one's called Ultimate Whitetail Strategy.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
That book first came out in 1990, and it was a series. Mm-hmm. It was Whitetail Strategies, and then Whitetail Strategies Volume 2, and then went to Whitetail Tactics. They've been a series. A lot of publishers got interested in the book because they sold so well.
Right.
And, today, one of the sidebars to that whole thing is I do a lot on food plots, and all the books I do other than the food plot book are on tactics on white.
Right.
So I enjoy that a lot. And, you know, I got one of the most often questions that comes up about whitetail deer, one of the more common ones is the rut and the phases of the rut, and you know, all the different fallacies about the rut. It's one of the most topics that has the most misguided information or misinformation about what the rut is really about.
That's actually what I have you on to talk about today. Good lead-in for me. I want to say this before we jump into the questions, is that your book, Whitetail Strategy, the original Whitetail Strategies, was the first book that I had read that actually gave, how can I put this, like it was actually taught me something where most of the other books were written in a sense, and not to bash the other books that I read, but they were all like, if you want to kill big whitetail, you need to go where big whitetail are.
Right.
Yeah, those are the type of statements are. You know, instead
I really
of,
appreciate the accolade because
well deserved. I mean, what I guess what I was getting at is there's a lot of people that might be really good hunters, but that doesn't make them very good teachers. And you you have both, and you've always been able to put it in language and explain it that somebody could digest it and use it into their own skill set. And when I wrote my book, I not that I don't want to use the word modeled, but I can't think of a better word. I modeled that after that idea that you had, the way that you did things, when I wrote my Whitetail book. And yeah, no, I wanted to let you know that that book was, back in 1990 was a turning point for me,
Well, thank
in
you.
my whitetail hunting, and I apply a lot to the way. So.
One of the nicest compliments I've ever received on that book. I appreciate it very much, especially coming from you. I'd love to, by the way, I'd love to get a copy of your book. I'll trade you out one of my new ones for one of those.
Definitely, I'll shoot you over. I'll
Yeah.
send you over the digital version of it.
Well,
I don't have any more paper.
I try to keep it in a conversational tone. Even with my television show, I've always tried to share information, not give information. And I've always tried to keep it away from watch me hunt, or, even in my books, this is all about me and how good I am or how bad I could be,
Right,
I just
right.
try to share information. I really steer totally away from it's all about me type of thing. And so many of the shows, the TV shows and even books are written in a way that they make the average hunter feel like he's just not capable of shooting a good buck, and that's just not the case. You got to live where
Yeah.
good bucks are. If you want to kill 170s, you can't hunt them, consistently hunt them and get them in New York. And that's a tough road to hoe in New York.
Right. Right.
So,
Although
but
I gotta say
it
that there's been some big boys coming out of there lately.
out of where?
Out of New York lately.
Oh yeah,
I
no,
have
there's definitely
yeah.
170 class bucks in New York,
Oh
but for
yeah.
the average
Yeah.
hunter, it's a tough road. I mean, you gotta,
No,
most
that's
times,
tough for anywhere. Yeah.
yeah. That's very
For
true,
sure.
but if you're living in Iowa, there's more of a chance of killing a 170 than there is in New York.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Kansas or Minnesota was, the soil has to have the minerals needed in order to produce that kind of antler.
Yeah.
So, but the everyday hunter is more, more interested in getting information, especially about the rut. Oh my gosh, the times and the rumors about it are rampant, especially for new hunters. But I've had some old hunters with steadfast ideas about the rut, for instance, that it's only stirred on by cold weather. And I
Oh,
mean, there
God.
couldn't be
I
anything
had that
further
argument
from
all
the
the time.
truth. Yeah, I mean, the rut
Yeah.
is, and it's funny because, you talk to an old timer and many newcomers to the sport that, and I'm only giving New York as an example. It could be New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, or any state anywhere. And people talk about the rut being spurred on by cold weather when, in fact, it's nothing more than the decrease in light, and which is absorbed through the preorbital gland in the corner of the deer's eye. That sets the rut off. It sets off a chemical reaction. And the one factor related to cold weather is that there's more diurnal, more daytime activity. So some guys will say, my friend is hunting up in the Adirondacks, and he said the rut is on, bucks are chasing everywhere, and the rut's just not on here. Well, it's on, it's just happening more nocturnally, when it's a little cooler. So it doesn't mean you shouldn't be using rut strategies. You should. See,
Right.
that one of the things I tell everybody is you got to remember that light affects the latitude and longitude across a given section across the country. For instance, from 40 degrees longitude latitude to 45 degrees takes in every state from New York, Pennsylvania, all the way out west. Takes in most of Montana, most of Wyoming, states that people think the rut is so much different. And I tell people, if you want to really prove to yourself about certain dates of the rut. And I'll talk about that now, but I'll give you absolute hardcore facts about it in a little bit here. Mm-hmm. The rut most times in those latitudes and longitudes, 40 to 45 degrees, are going to happen like clockwork. Mother Nature, perfect in her design, doesn't depend on cold weather to make the rut happen. She can't. You know, even in Texas, South Texas and Alabama, deer are breeding when it's 85, 75, 85, and 90 degrees.
Yep.
It's just the way it is. But if you call any outfitter out in Montana, for instance, or one of the western Rocky Mountain states and say, look, I want to be out there when the whitetail rut is really at its peak, you know, the primary rut, 90% of the time they're going to tell you that's going to be mid-November.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not 95% of the time, and that's when the rut is, it's mid-November, I get a kick out of the articles that are in a lot of magazines that they're predicting the rut this year is going to be this date and that date and this date.
Yeah.
I have kept accurate records on the rut since the second year I started hunting, and I don't even want to tell you how long that is, but it's over 50 years. And like clockwork, the rut falls, the primary rut, falls between November 10th and November 15th, give or take a few days on either side of that, like clockwork. Warmer weather, cold weather, snow. You know, the only thing that's going to change that is drastic changes in weather or food sources or predation. Then what happens is a doe will skip her cycle. I often tell people, it's like, you know, when you go home and tell your wife, you know what, honey, I forgot to pay all the MasterCard and credit card bills, and they're coming after us. I can guarantee you she's going to skip a cycle. You just made her very upset. You know?
Yeah.
And that's what happens with a doe. If there's forces like too much ice, lack of snow, extreme flooding,
drought.
You know?
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's happening those dates. And it's not going to matter. One of the big factors that people recently talked about is the moon phase theories.
Right.
In one of my latest books, if you don't mind, I'll mention it.
Yeah, go ahead.
The RX for Deer Hunting Success. And I have a chapter on scientific research debunks moon phase theories. I interviewed 13 well-known biologists in this industry. And to the man, they all agree that that moon phase does not affect when the rut is going to happen, period. It has nothing to do with the rut. And getting that message out, I'm sorry?
I said it's the same as the weather. It just affects when their movement is, not the actual biological rut that's happening.
Yeah, and trying to get that message out, it was hard in the beginning, but more and more people are starting to realize, you know, that the moon phase theory, and almost everybody who preaches moon phase theories sells moon phase theory charts. and although I admire and respect a lot of the guys who talk about moon phase and the rut on this particular subject, they are dead wrong. And it's supported by scientific, you know, information and by biologists everywhere. I mean, 13 biologists that are known within the industry gave hardcore facts that I put in the book about why that's not true. But it's obvious that Mother Nature couldn't depend on that. I mean, Mother Nature, you know, you gotta depend on the least amount of things to get the species perpetuated, right?
Right.
And so she makes it so that it's going to be when it's going to be, and despite most obstacles, it'll happen. I mean, when you think about it, there are three phases of the rut that everybody contends with. You got the pre-rut, the post, the primary rut, and the post-rut. And one of the phases that everybody overlooks, which is I nicknamed the big chase, happens just
prior
to the primary rut. And yep. if you're in the woods, it's mid-October, and you haven't seen much sign, but then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, one day, you see these little scrapes everywhere. And people always say, I see these little scrapes. And well, you know, those are or what happened there is every given doe in any given herd, and I don't care if it's in New York or Wyoming, comes into a very brief estrus cycle. It's usually 24 to 36 hours, and it's the adult does within those given herds. They come in, mm-hmm. it's meant to kickstart the rut, and you get this activity where a bunch of bucks who are still in bachelor herds, you know, they're walking out of the swamp and over to an apple orchard, they get wind of that scent, and they go nuts. They start digging up little scrapes, hoping maybe she'll come here or maybe she'll come there. You know, they're excited. They waited a year for this. Anybody would get excited, right?
Absolutely.
But those scrapes are totally useless to hunt over, yet they are key factors in information. You count 28 to 30 days or 32 days from when you find the first opened up scrape, that little scrape, not after it's been covered up after a few days, leaves and stuff, when it's first bare to the ground, and you've got the exact period of the primary rut. And then you count 28 to 32 days from there, and you've got one of the best ruts going is when all those fawns and yearling deer that haven't been bred, mm-hmm. and even some adult does who haven't been bred, come into what they call the post rut, the last rut. And many times that rut can be one of the best ruts going because one or two does are only in heat, and those two does are attracting lots of bucks.
Yep.
You know, New York, you cut me off whenever you think I'm rambling on too much. Yeah, New York
not at all.
New York did an 8-year study on the rut, and this kind of proves the theory I'm talking about. And in 8 years, they took 100 roadkill does from across different parts of the state, and they opened the doe up, and they took a fetal gauge out, and they measured the fetuses. And what they discovered is this, and this is a research that's on their website. You got to search around a lot to find it, but it's there. They found that the rut is a lot longer than people think it is. It's sometimes they had a little blip on the graph that showed a doe was actually bred in very early October, in a couple of years in late September.
Mm-hmm.
Then they found that there was a little spike toward the end of October, right around Halloween, which has always been a good day, and a few more does were bred. Then they found a huge spike that meant a majority of the does over the 8 years were bred in mid-November, and then they found another significant spike, not significant, let me rephrase that. They found another noticeable spike again in December, which is that late post-rut.
Right.
And here's the interesting part. The 8 years running, they found that there was there were does, and the numbers weren't many out of 100 does that they took the samples from. One or two were bred in January.
Wow.
And for 8 years, they found one doe every year in February was bred out of the 100. That's amazing to most hunters. But the fact
right.
is, as long as a buck has antlers on his head, and as long as a doe hasn't been successfully bred, she'll come into, according to that study, she'll come into estrus every 28 to 32 days from mid to late September, right through March.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. When I say to my seminars, and I'll say to guys, how many fellows have actually or women seen bucks carrying antlers in March? I always get two or three hands going up. But
Everybody
else looks like I just talk Chinese to them. And they didn't get it, but it's true. Bucks carry their antlers a lot longer than most hunters realize they do. And as long as they
sure.
have those antlers, if a doe goes by and sees she's an estrus, she's getting bred. Now, that doesn't mean she's going to successfully bear that doe, that fawn.
Right.
But she can get bred.
Yeah, there's a lot of does that can't get bred, and then they keep going back into cycle, you know, go back into cycle, back into cycle. And if there's a forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think the reason why that the bucks hold their antlers long is if they're smelling, you know, breedable does, that then their antlers stay on. It doesn't trigger the you know, the hormones to drop, because their testosterone's high.
Right. Again, and that's right on. But it's good information, because what happens with that, when a buck starts to drop his antlers, is all, again, just like when the rut is being put on, it's amount of daylight. As the daylight increases, the hormones start to decrease. The buck's testicles go back up into his scrotum, and the chemicals for testosterone and everything start to wane considerably, and his antlers fall off.
Right. You know, and now we're talking about white-tailed deer here as an example, but the truth is it's all cherevid. It's elk, mule deer, blacktail. It's all.
And
moose,
that includes
it's all.
Caribou, it includes moose, all of them.
Absolutely.
You know, the rut is one of the windows of opportunity, but although there are three different times you can capitalize on that window, on those small windows, during the primary rut, it's the time when you have the most windows to capitalize on it, and that again is, you know, from that November 10th to November 15th period, and that's when you really got to take into consideration, okay, what strategies do I want to use? How, you know, what do I got to do to get one of these bucks who's, you know, chasing does around? And then you could use a variety of different rut type strategies.
Right. Well, I wanted to back up, because I wanted to, the does coming into estrus at different times is usually depends on when they were born, isn't that correct? Like, if a doe is born,
to a degree, because you got to remember, you know, a doe has the capability when she's bred too late in the season to absorb one of the fetuses, and then if the weather's really bad, she'll even absorb the second one. So most late fawns, most late born fawns, are going to be successfully had by the doe.
Okay.
That fawn may come in later, her first season, but eventually she falls into, oh, I almost said she's going to fall into the rut. Can you believe this? She falls into the natural process of having a reliable rut. It's just like young female, that first and even second period that they come into could be abnormal. Could be abnormal.
Right.
She definitely could come in early or late, but eventually she falls into coming into a very reliable 28 to 32-day period in a very reliable way. She has to, in order to keep the species going on a consistent basis.
Right. Now, I remember when I was doing my research for my book that one of the things that I saw consistently was that the intensity of the rut, or the primary rut, had a lot to do with how your buck-to-doe ratio, how close it was.
It had a lot to do with activity, right?
Well, not activity, but, well, yeah, of course, activity-wise, you know, meaning bucks have more competition, so there's going to be more, you know, fighting and whatnot. But that if there was a closer buck-to-doe ratio and a healthier, you know, herd, so to speak, that most of the doe would, even more doe would come into estrus
at the same time frame. They were more closely connected, where it wasn't such a trickle rut, so to speak.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
You're talking about a majority of the dose coming in basically at a certain period of time together.
Right. That's correct.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Because, again, that's Mother Nature. You know, she can't make a lot of mistakes and hope it works. She tries to make it work, you know, by making things happen on a regular basis. And a buck-to-doe ratio, there's so much more, you know, good buck-to-doe ratio, there's so much more than that as well. I mean, as you probably know this. You know, it gives you more sign, gives you more activity during daylight hours. A healthy herd means a lot of success for a hunter when he sees, you know, more sightings, more kill ratios rise. The herd is healthy. And in an herd that's not so healthy, you know, you got scattered bucks chasing does here and there, and even the does are irregular as far as coming into a site. You know, maybe for a healthy herd, it's within a 3-day period where a majority are bred, and for a not so healthy herd, it might be spread over 7 days.
Right. Well, we see that a lot out here in Arizona with the coos deer. That, I mean, it seems that the rut, I mean, there's that sweet week, you know, where you'll see a real lot of, you know, a lot of rutting activity in 1 week. But really, you could see those being bred in December and all the way to into February. And
it's real
spread out. And part of that has to do with the fact that our dota buck ratio is way off in our,
that goes back to proving that theory about the latitude and longitude. You know, the further south you go, the much longer the rut. And Texas has their rut in January in certain parts of South Texas. And Alabama and all of those said that as soon as you get out of that or get into a certain longitude and latitude where the light is different, the rut is going to be different. You hunt in northern parts of Montana and even into some of the provinces, the rut is different. The dates are different, not significantly, but they're different. They're no longer that November 10th to 15th. They could be the 15th to the 20th. And it's just the same with warm locations. It happens different times. And it can stretch out in warmer locations much longer than it can in colder locations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I've witnessed that all over the Southwest, and you know, I hunted a lot in like Alabama and stuff like that that were just much longer, much further, not quite as intense of a rut, like, you know, for any given date. But I've seen here, I have a trail cam picture from a couple of years back of a coos buck still packing his horns June 1st. Oh, yeah, June 1st. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's a hard point to sell to some hunters because they're, you know, it's like the old adage, hang your deer out for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks and it'll improve the meat. Well, it'll improve the meat because the meat is rotting. You know, you want to age your deer properly. You need to age it between, you know, certain temperatures, not fluctuating temperatures, and certainly not hanging it outside where it's, you know, undergoing all sorts of different temperatures and different conditions. Plus getting, I don't know how many eggs laid in by so many different types of bugs, you know?
Yep, absolutely. So
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. I was going to ask you a question, but go ahead.
One of the things that you find out even in about the rut that is such a misunderstood situation is that older bucks don't really breed a majority of the does. And I had a chapter in that new book again that I again interviewed biologists, both biologists who hunt and biologists who don't, who just do research. And on this particular subject, I think there was 6 or 8 biologists that I interviewed, and they all agreed that adult bucks don't get the opportunity to breed as many deer, many does, as so many hunters believe they do. You know, that old
right.
The dominant buck theory is such a misnomer, it's not funny. I mean, it's a pecking order. It's not, I'm the biggest, baddest buck, I'll breed all the does, you watch me breed them. That just doesn't happen in the whitetail world. It just doesn't happen. And no. What happens is, I've seen adult bucks watch 6 and 4 and even spike bucks breed a doe in their presence. I've seen the same the situation where an adult buck is looked to skewer that buck as well if he could get his hands on him on some occasions. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't allow that buck to breed another doe. It just means that he's not going to tolerate his presence around him and other does. And so he breeds a couple, you know, say, I don't know what the percentage is, even if it's 40%, it's not 90%. And so guys get stuck in that dominant buck tactics, and dominant buck type tactics makes for lonely hunters.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's true.
They sit in a stand and they chase away all the other bucks. That leads into poor calling techniques. And poor calling technique. You know, one of the primary ways to kill a deer is to really learn all the different vocalizations and all the sub cadences of each primary mm-hmm. vocalization, and how, when, where, and why to use them. And that includes rattling and using deer calls, and mm-hmm. and even to some degree if you use decoys, but. Rattling and using deer calls are deer are very vocal. You know that. I mean,
oh yeah.
But I have talked to seasoned veterans who can't, other than the grunt and an occasional blat, they don't know about any other of the deer vocalizations that are out there. For instance, the snort. You talk to 100 hunters about the snort call, and that it's probably the best darn call there is to use all season long, and they stare at me and wonder. It's almost like they're staring and saying, "Is this guy for real?" But it's one of the best calls you can use. The snort has six different sub cadences. There's the alarm distress, the alarm, the social. What they call the buck wheeze, and then the buck snort wheeze, which is way too aggressive calls. Most times you're going to chase more bucks away using those two calls than you'll ever attract. But each one of those calls that I just mentioned on the snort do different things. For instance, how many times have you gone to your stand and it's just before light and you bump a deer? You don't see it, but you bump it. And you hear a snort, and then there's a hesitation, and you hear another snort. That's an alarm. It's called an alarm vocalization. And that alarm is basically a deer that's never winded the hunter, and it's never seen the hunter. It heard something approaching, and so it blows an alarm. And if you answer that deer, you can carry on a conversation with that deer until you get enough light to see what it was. It could be a buck. And instead, guys get so frustrated by that, I blew the morning, and they march on to the stand, or they march through the woods in a different direction, and then that deer goes from blowing an alarm to an alarm distress. And then she's he's just cleared out the woods for you.
Do you have a distress call, or do you have a snort with you right now? Can you give us an example of it?
Yes.
Yeah, please.
This is the alarm. It's crucial when you're making that call. Now, I'll repeat that. It's absolutely crucial to blow two calls with a hesitation between one and two. If you blow them too quickly together, you lose the deer. So you have to know that when you bump a deer and it blows two calls at you. And you can have a conversation with that deer, especially if it's still a little too dark for the deer to see you and you to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But once that deer, you sense that deer is getting too close, 40 yards, 50 yards away from you, you got to stop calling. You just got to let its curiosity build up, and it'll keep coming. Otherwise, it's going to make you. It's just like a, you know, a gobbler. He knows he knows the branch you're sitting on from 500 yards away. Well, that's
right.
The same thing for a deer. They know exactly where you, that sound's coming from. But that particular snort call can save the day for you. It really can. And you just have to have the fortitude that when you hear it, to stop and reply to it and not keep going and just stay there. Freeze in your spot. If you're standing, keep standing. If you got a tree to go behind that's right near you, ease into the tree and keep that going. Every time she snorts twice or he snorts twice, you snort back. And it will snort and you will snort. And that deer, you'll notice the body language is always the same. They start to they'll pick up their head. They'll stretch their neck out. They'll start to stiff leg toward you, and they keep coming because they think what they heard was just another deer. And now they need to find that deer. Safety in numbers, you know.
Yep.
So it's a great
I've used that tactic a couple of times. I showed one of my cousins that one time. It was getting right at dusk. It was getting right at dark, and we were walking in, and a doe and a fawn. And I started stomping and snorting, and it started coming towards us.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
I always tell guys, you know, you use the different cadences in conjunction of what type of strategy you're using them for. And some of them are used just to stop deer as well. This alarm distress call of a snort, I'll give you here's how this call can work. Any time during the year, you're walking in and you're going past a ledge and there's some laurels below you, or you blow downs, or there's a standing cornfield. Anywhere you think a buck might be hiding, or a doe might be hiding, what you can do is act on a deer's instinctive behavior. Let's say I'm walking through the woods slowly toward my stand and I see a bunch of blowdowns. What I want to do is I want to act on a buck's instinctive behavior. Since he's been born, the doe has taught him, when I blow this vocalization, there's no hiding. This is an extreme dangerous situation, and you need to get out of here. You need to get where you are to another place safely. So if you know that, right, you've seen it how many times as a hunter. When a doe blows an alarm distress, everything clears out of a field, or every deer in the woods starts to run. They don't even have to pick up their head. They know what that sound means. It's predation. It's whatever the message is to them, it's very clear that it's danger, immediate danger. So let's say you're walking through a place where you think a buck might be hiding in those blowdowns. What I do is I take out a little interdigital scent. Interdigital is that gland between the toes on a deer's hoof. Every time they put a minute amount of interdigital down, is how they, or every time they put their hoof down, they're leaving a little minute scent of interdigital.
Right.
It's how they follow each other. It's how they locate each other. But when a deer stops and starts stomping, when it's nervous about something or it's trying to relate danger, it stands in place and it keeps stomping. What it's doing is not only leaving an audible message with the thumping, it's leaving a chemical message that of interdigital, hey, I had trouble here. This is an area where you got to be careful. So another deer comes down the trail, they smell that excess interdigital, they freeze in their tracks, and you can notice, you could test this out of season, and you'll see that they'll hit that scent, excess interdigital scent, they'll stop, they'll start to pace, they get nervous, and they either go wide around it or they turn around and walk back. So when
I've had that happen before.
I
was in Canada, and I went to hunt with an outfitter, and I was sitting in a tree stand that was just way, way too low. And every deer that came down the trail, it didn't matter if I was moving or not, would look up and catch me in that tree.
Right.
And I was like, just, we got to get out of here. But of course, you know, they'd get to that one spot and they'd start stomping. And then sure enough, after a while, every deer that came down that trail, they would hit that spot and they would just automatically, you know, just start looking in every direction.
They didn't
to see what the deal was. Yeah.
They didn't know anything more. They knew that there was a problem there. So let's say you want to see if that buck is behind those, you know, if there's a buck or a doe behind the blowdown or in the laurels or in the standing cornfield that you can't see. Take out some interdigital. Put one, you know, don't put one or two drops down. Put several. And I don't even care if the wind is against you. It actually makes this more realistic because all of a sudden they start to smell it. Let's say they pick up the odor of a human being. Well, most adult bucks especially, but even younger bucks, all that means is they're going to get tighter into the cover that they're in, right? Many bucks let you pass right by. But now you add in, after you put the interdigital down, you add the alarm distress. Do you want me to blow that?
Yes, please.
Hunters have all heard that noise.
Yep. While they're running away.
Right? And the deer is gone. So now you've added something instinctively to the game, to the tactic, that the buck just cannot ignore. He can't ignore it. It's like when you make a mock scrape or a mock rub and you do certain things right with it, he can't ignore going to it. It's instinctive behavior. Same thing with this. He now thinks, holy mackerel, I smelled something. I heard the stomping of the foot, because after you put the interdigital down, you just stomp your foot a few times. And now I heard the call. I got to get up and go. And so while things can happen fast, in certain situations, sometimes they'll just stand up to look to see what's going on, and you just put a deer in your sights that you might have walked right by. I've done it in standing cornfields where you get to the corner of the standing cornfield and you blow the alarm distress and a buck comes out one way or the other, or a doe. Guys can use it as a team. They can go to a swamp, set up on escape runs, and one guy penetrates the swamp by 30 yards, lets everything calm down for a few minutes, and then start blowing the alarm distress. If there's a buck or doe in there, it's going out one of the escape routes, and bango, somebody's gets to see a deer. So it's an excellent call. And then there's a social snort. The social snort is really a neat way to stop deer in their tracks. And, you know, some going by you out of range if you're hunting with a bow, or within range, and you want to stop the deer, you blow a social snort. It's very gentle. I'll blow it. And it's not to be blown loudly. The other two snorts you can blow fairly loudly. No call should be over-aggressive, but you can blow, as a deer would make it natural sounding. But this one, you intentionally keep it low. Many times, you ever see a deer come out to a field where other deer are, and before the deer comes out, the deer that are feeding, you know, they're starting to feeding, all of a sudden all their heads get up and they stare in one direction.
Yep.
And they stare and they stare and their ears get cupped in that direction. And they watch and they look, and then all of a sudden a deer steps out. And they heard that deer coming in from a long distance away. Many times that deer will blow a social snort. And if you listen hard enough, you'll hear it. Many times, for many years, I never heard it. And then when I started to put two and two together and I started researching it a lot, I concentrated on hearing it when I had ears that could do this. And you can hear it. It's a very low snort. It's a single snort. And it's very brief. It isn't extended. And it's just a hello. It's me. You know, that's basically the message being sent. So if a deer is walking by you in range with a bow, or you know, you want to stop it when it's walking, and you, even with a firearm, you blow that social snort, and they stop. Not maybe, you know, not for a long period of time, but they stop and they look around, and sometimes they'll even answer with a social snort. Not all the time, but sometimes they will. Look, none of these tactics work all the time, right? I mean, if that was the case, there wouldn't be any deer alive anymore. But the reality is, the more you know about the tactic that you're using, whether it's making a mock rub or a mock scrape or gear calls or the grunt tube, which is one of the most misunderstood and misused calls, the more success you're going to have.
Yeah.
Right? That grunt call, I guarantee you, I'm not going to say 90, but I guarantee you 75% of the guys who and women who use a grunt tube use it inappropriately, and that's because they read the hype on the grunt tube. You know, you've heard about the bark and you've heard about the growl, and there is no such thing as a bark or a growl with a grunt tube. I mean, maybe in research areas or penned areas, you might get a deer that grunts over aggressively. But anybody who's hunted for any length of time knows that 99.9999999 tenths of the time, a grunt is a very guttural and soft call from a buck. It's a tight sound. And when you're using your grunt call, if you're using it the directions that some of the manufacturers put on the packages, you know, bark like a dog and growl like a, you know, it's ridiculous. You know, it'll get you the dominant buck. It'll get you a day without seeing deer. what you want to do with the grunt call is learn how to use it properly. There are really two calls that you should master. Anybody who wants to see deer every now and then grunting, and you've heard the story, I'll bet, as many times as I had. You know, I grunted at a buck last year. He came right in. This year,
right.
Same time, same location, I grunted at a deer, and he just kept walking. And I keep talking to him, well, what'd you do, and how'd you do it? And next thing I know, the guy, well, I blew it, and I didn't think he heard me, so I blew it a little louder. And then he kept going, and I blew a little louder. And then, and of course, the deer. Now you're telling the deer, hey, you know what, I'm going to kick your butt.
Right.
And so I don't care if it's an adult deer or not. Most adult deer don't want to have physical confrontation. They want to exert their pecking order with what? Body language. They don't want to risk getting hurt. And so they hear that big, that group being made so aggressively. Okay, Mr. Big Bag Buck, I heard you, and I'm going to leave. Don't bother, you know, don't come chase me. But if you learn the two, if you learn what they call the trail grunt and the tending grunt, those two grunts,
mm-hmm.
Put a deer in your sights or in your scope most often than any of the other grunts that you know that are out there that are supposedly do that trick for you. They won't.
Do you have your grunt tube with you?
You know, I don't, but I'd be happy to another time to do that for you.
Yeah, no, definitely want to have you on and kind of.
You know, the grunt is
yeah.
As I said in the book, is the most misused and misunderstood. And here's something else about the grunt tube. Don't think you're going to
mm-hmm.
buy a grunt tube, and I tell this to readers and on the TV show, and get a lot of use out of it. It's a
right.
very short window of opportunity.
Yep.
That's a fact of life. That's the fact of the rut. But during that period, especially the big chase, that falls between that pre-rut and that primary rut, and it's usually a 5 to 6 day period, Halloween being usually the kickoff date. You ever have real
yeah.
success hunting whitetails on Halloween?
Oh yeah,
it's a
especially
great day. It just
especially on Long
end.
Island.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great day, but it's the day that a lot of bucks start to really, the testosterone has really started to build up from that pre-rut, and now they start grunting a lot, and that 5 or 6 day period is sometimes the key factor in grunting in a buck during that big chase phase, and it leads right up into the tenth. That doesn't mean that the grunt won't work from Halloween to about the 20th of November. It can, but it has its peaks
mm-hmm.
and valleys.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I feel like my favorite call, or the call that I've had the most success with, is your bleat blat type sound.
Sure.
I like the really small can that kind of sounds like a fawn, maybe.
Like the one I'm holding?
Probably.
Yeah, you're right. It is an excellent call. The blat, there's another misnomer about that, about the bleat and blat. A blat is made by an adult deer. And like just like in with humans, you know, when you're a youngster, you have a voice that sounds like this. You know, you talk a little higher, you know, and when you're
right.
an adult, that voice deepens. The same thing, but unfortunately, most manufacturers reserve the word bleat to cover all the blat calls made by a deer.
Right.
A blat is basically an adult, and a bleat is a youngster. Now, what you can do to separate that, if it says young bleat, the manufacturer means it's a fawn call, and which is an excellent call to use, especially during bow season. Holy smokes, that's a great call. But
yep,
the black call would mostly be referred to as just a bleat, not young bleat. Bleat. It's really a blat, but it's just a matter of how you use the word, I guess. But the blat call has the social blat, the alarm blat, the feeding blat, the warning blat, the estrus blat. Learn those calls, boy,
distress.
A home run. The how many times I try to tell these guys, you know, I get to a seminar, the 30, 40 people in there, and I say, how many guys use this can, or how many people use this can? And use it, and here's the key word now, use it consistently. Well, first I ask them, use it successfully. A lot of hands go up. Then I'll say,
right.
how many have used it consistently successfully? And now 90% of the hands go down, and there's a few guys who've used it consistently successfully. And the reason is, most manufacturers tell you to use the can, and the call that they're using is really the alarm blat. So that alarm blat, the guy's in his stand and he's blind calling, and a deer may hear it 40 yards away, and they come trotting by, and he says, wow, it worked. Well, it did.
Yeah.
But you frightened the deer. That's why it went by. And you can notice this when you're using the alarm blat, if the deer is moving quickly or trotting, then you really blew the alarm blat. The estrus blat is also, and I nicknamed this, 10 years ago, I call it the stutter blat. Starting last year, more and more packages on the bleat call, on the what I call the blat call, are now calling it the skipper blat, the stutter blat. When a doe gets in a peak estrus period, she becomes more vocal. She attracts the buck by flagging her tail one way or the other. She attracts him through her urine, but she also attracts him vocally. If he's not in the correct wind of her estrus, she can look at him, flag a tail, and give a blat. And that message is as clear as the estrus in her urine to that buck. Holy smokes, she's an estrus, and she's ready to stand. And that estrus blat, I'll make it for you, that estrus blat is a little stutter blat. Sounds like this. Do you hear that little stutter?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That little stutter is an instinctive tactic. When a buck hears that stutter sound, and I made it a little loud there, you know, just to demonstrate it. But when he hears, and a little longer than I should have made it, but when a buck hears that stutter sound, it's a message that is clear as the nose on the end of his snout, his face. It says very clearly to him, I'm ready to stand. Because that's the only time a doe does it. When she's in that 24 to 36 hour period where she is ready to stand for a buck. So now you've hit on an instinctive behavior that absolutely, positively cannot be ignored by the buck.
Yep.
You just got to know when to use it. Hit that estrus blat on a time when you want to stop a deer from running. There's no point. You're not gonna accomplish the goal. If you want to stop a deer, and I don't care how fast it's running, you take walking or trotting. You take that can and you do it the direction, say you make that long bah type sound. You hear that long sound? Yep. That'll stop any deer in its tracks. It's an alarm blat. You could even make it with your mouth. That's a bleh. Now, I've noticed over the years, does will stop much longer than bucks, and that's because they're protecting, you know, the yearlings and the fawns, so they want to really know what's going on. A buck will stop, and he'll try his best to get an idea where that came from. Once he knows it came from my right, I'm going left. But he stops long enough sometimes to get, you know, your bow drawn on him or put him in the scope.
Yep.
It's an excellent way to stop the deer. So, you know, there are different sub-cadences of all these calls that guys should learn and practice. And here's the key, John. If you're going to go buy a deer call and you're not going to take that call, or you're going to buy it in November and you're going to go out to the woods to use it, even if it's the first time or if it's the 50th time, you're fooling yourself. Like anything else you do in life, you got to do it well. So buy your call in July and go out to a field and blow an alarm's distress call when you see, with a snort, when you see a bunch of deer in the field, pick up the alarm distress, blow it. If every deer clears out of that field, you blew the alarm distress correctly. Blow a social snort the next time. If they pick up their head and they start walking toward you or toward the sound, they shouldn't see you, but toward the sound, you've now learned how to use that social snort. Same thing with a grunt. The reason nobody practices with it is because it's hunting season, you know. Mm-hmm. But there are social grunts. Does grunt. So if you go out and make a social grunt in September and October and you're getting reaction to it, then you know you're not blowing it too aggressively. You're blowing it at the right distance. I tell guys, try to do it in fields so you can get confident that you don't have to blow on these things so hard in the woods that you're overblowing. Blow it at a deer 200 yards away. Guarantee the deer will hear it.
Oh, yeah.
And don't blow it so hard. One of the things that I just want to back up on that I don't want to forget mention, one of the best uses I get out of the snort call, how many times you're sitting in your stand and it's getting time to leave and you don't want to get out of the stand because there's deer everywhere, right?
Right.
And you don't want them to associate you sitting in that stand and then avoiding that stand. Take out the alarm distress, turn to one direction or another away from, you know, where the sound is going to resonate out into a different direction, and blow an alarm distress. The field will clear out. You'll get out of your stand without blowing the deer out of there and having them associate you in that stand with danger.
Right.
An excellent way of getting out of a stand and where you don't have to worry about giving the stand away or that, you know, a person scared the deer away. So there's some of the ways, you know, you can improve some tactics that definitely, you know, can help a hunter get successful. Maybe next time I come on, I could talk about that grunt call and maybe we'll talk about if you think it would be something that's interesting. How to create a mock rub or a mock scrape.
Oh, absolutely. That was actually one of the questions I had on my list to ask you. But,
well, go ahead.
We started we started going down a different road, and I'm happy. I mean, you made my job super easy. We could probably do 30 podcasts and still not, you know, get everything. But I definitely want to have you back on and talk about some of these other things, and maybe I'd like to
do that.
I'd like to, because I've done this in my life, because, you know, my roots started with whitetail hunting because I grew up in New York, and even though I've been living out in the West since 91, I've been here longer than I actually lived in New York. I always went back to hunt whitetail, you know, back east, and I used to go to Illinois a lot.
Hard to get away from, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I lived in Colorado for a lot of years, and I had to come back to New York to hunt.
I'm surprised you picked New York, though. I mean, instead of like Iowa or something like, you know, crazy.
You know, I don't know what attracts me so much to New York. I often wondered the same question about myself. I mean, when I lived in Colorado, it was great hunting. Mm-hmm. I mean, unbelievable hunting.
Oh, yeah.
But I want to come. I wanted to come back to New York and hunt whitetails.
Yeah, yeah. There's some pretty good whitetails in Colorado too. There's some damn good whitetails in Colorado. But I definitely like to have you back on and
talk
about how some of these things relate to hunting other animals as well. Because I've actually noticed, so you mentioned just now, you made me think of elk hunting when you talked about calling, not having to call so loudly. Like, I realized this several years back, when I was doing, cow calls and stuff on elk, I was doing it too loud. And I realized when I went really, really soft, super soft, where I would think that somebody was that 100 yards away couldn't hear, these animals were hearing them from 300, 400, 500 yards away.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah, God designed those calls that they carry through the woods.
Yeah.
Because of the tone. And it's pretty nuts. So
sound travels. It's amazing how sound travels and how animals pick it up. An elephant could stomp its foot and they could pick up, other elephants could pick up the vibration 6-8 miles away. That's incredible to me. That's absolutely incredible. Yet a study was done in Minnesota on deer stomping, and they found that vibration could be picked up 0.5 mile to 1 mile away.
Wow.
That's imagine nuts. That. So you're not only scaring that deer when she's stomping or he's stomping, that deer's scaring every other deer that's within 0.5 mile of you and at any rate.
That's crazy.
So sound does travel.
That makes me think when you're stalking a deer, out here and out west, we do a lot of spot and stalk. I mean, your footsteps must really carry a lot further than you think they do.
Flat-footed steps, you're not kidding. Footfalls can be the demise of a hunter going to a stand in the morning, heel to toe, heel to toe, heel to toe.
Yeah. What I learned one time, and I did it by accident, and I kind of do it now almost all the time, when I'm entering into a stand, when a deer is coming, when a deer is chasing, a buck is chasing a doe through the woods, and you got a lot of leaves on the ground, there's always that they run and then they stop for a little bit and then they run and it's kind of like a dance.
Right.
I started doing that and I can't tell you how many times I would have a deer come running in.
Now I know you read the first book. Now I know. That's right.
That's where I got that from. I got it from that from your first book.
Okay. The whole chapter.
I couldn't remember where I had learned that from. Okay, that's great. That's awesome. And I started doing that. Though it made me figure it out. Maybe I just put two and two together. Was I was in Illinois, and this is early 2000s, and I was like, I cannot get to this stand quietly. And I don't want to, for my afternoon hunt, I didn't want to make a lot of noise. I said, I'm going to make a lot of noise this first day, and that's it. What I started doing was shuffling the leaves with my boots and clearing myself a trail from
noise
the field. Shuffling my leaves and making a trail. And out of nowhere, here comes flying in like a bat out of hell. This, it was a basket rack buck, and I didn't end up shooting him, but come flying in, and came right out from underneath the bottom, and came flying up to me, and I was like, wow. And then, so from then on, I was like, oh, yeah, now I remember it in your book.
It's a big thing in rattling,
I associated the two. Yep. Oh, yeah, rattling, I always did that. Kicking leaves, breaking branches.
You rustle the leaves, you scrape the branches, and you know how many times I've had guys tell me, and I say guys, I mean people that hunt, women, men, that they're climbing a tree stand and climbing with their climber up in the tree, and a buck runs in because they're hearing the bark of the tree is being scraped and it's falling to the ground, and they attracted a buck. They couldn't believe it, but it's natural sounds often attract deer.
Yep.
And it's the littlest thing sometimes, shuffling your feet like you're talking about, going up in a tree stand and, you know, when you're rattling and scraping the antlers against the bark of the tree, when you're, you know, making a rub, make the rub with the antler instead of making it with a knife, because that antler has an odor to it. Even though it's,
right.
it's a dead antler, basically, it has an odor. It's bone. So everything has to be natural, you know. We'll talk about this another time, but, you know, there's 18 different scents a deer will leave at a scrape and a rub, and I'll name each scent, and I'll tell you where it comes from and how to use it. And when you use four or five of them, because you can't use all of them, a lot of them aren't made by manufacturers, but when you use a lot of them, you're basically sending a message, an instinctive message again. This was natural. It was made by another deer. I can't help myself. I've got to go check it out.
Right.
Cool. Yeah, definitely going to have you back on, especially,
well, thank you.
You know, when we get a little bit closer to season.
It's been a lot of fun.
Well, cool. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for thinking of me.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for coming on, and, you know, I'll get in touch with you, and we'll have you back on, and we'll get to some of these other topics.
And if anybody wants to get any of the information, they can go to any of my books. They can visit my website, which is deerdoctor.com. And how would I tie in a special on this podcast for you? Can I do that?
If you want, you could give us a promo code, maybe? Yeah.
Sure, I'll do that. I'll do that. And
make it my name, John Stallone, and then is that possible?
Sure. Whatever. We'll talk about it, and we'll whatever you think works, and we'll give them a super discount on the books.
There you go. Cool. Well, thanks again, and I will talk with you soon.
Okay, thanks, John. Peter. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So the boys over at Triple Threat Performance and I are going to be putting on a Hunt Fit session on August 4th at 8 a.m. at the Triple Threat Performance facility in Scottsdale. 8 a.m. August 4th. The class size is going to be limited, so if you want in on it, you need to RSVP me. Either hit me up on my Instagram or Facebook, or go to the blog johnstallone.me and send me an email. There'll also be some information on the class on my blog. So if you go to johnstallone.me, just search it, you'll find it. It's going to be a good class. Going to do a lot of cool stuff. Help you learn some new movements, possibly. Take a look at the way you're doing things now. And who knows, it might be a program you want to get into and you'll be working out alongside me. So we'd love to see you there. So please RSVP, tell a friend, Triple Threat Performance, August 4th, 8 a.m. Thank you.